You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai aki nei, coming up on the show, I speak to the ACT Party's Deputy Leader, Brooke Van Velden, about the government's recent package to address retail crime. I also spoke to Izzy Renton and Maria Kopilevich from Students Supporting the Tertiary Education Union about why they think it's important for students to be behind staff in their latest strike action for better pay. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Troy. How are you today, Troy?
I'm good, thank you.
You're good? Sorry to catch you off guard there.
That's okay.
This is your second Wire on air. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good.
Can you tell us a bit about the piece you've got planned for us for Green Desk?
I spoke with researcher Sam Laidwig about the effects of microplastics in the Waitemata Harbour.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai. Text us on 5395. Wire mai rane. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oa e wariwari I ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ere kōrero ano he pakihiri roki roki mā runga I te pai tuku tuku o irirangi pōho mihaere ki 95 BFM, ira kati.com. Catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95 BFM website, 95bfm.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden.
Now it's time for our chat with one of the most important minor parties about the political hot potatoes of today and tomorrow. The government recently launched a multi-million dollar package to tackle retail crime and reoffending after concerns about a lack of protection for retail workers. This announcement came just hours after dozens of protests were held around the country following the tragic death of Auckland dairy worker Janak Patel. I spoke to ex-Brooke Van Velden about her thoughts on this package.
Retailers up and down New Zealand are constantly telling me that they don't feel safe at work and they don't feel safe on the way to work. There are people who have been robbed multiple times who don't feel like they've been listened to. And while it's good that the government is saying that they're now going to listen and they'll be there for retailers who are scared and anxious about just trying to do their jobs in the community, we're not really seeing the money actually getting out the door. If you take the example of fog cannons, the government has promised that they would put in place fog cannons to keep retailers who have been a victim of a ram raid safe. We've only seen a handful of those installed in the community. The money is there, but it's not being spent. And that's not good enough for people who genuinely are the cornerstone of our communities.
Jacinda Ardern has rejected the idea that it took the recent tragedy, the death of Janak Patel, to trigger this new crime prevention scheme. Do you believe that this is accurate?
Oh, look, I'm as cynical as they come when it comes to the government being focused on polling and focus groups and being reactionary rather than proactive. We have heard for years that retailers aren't safe and they want real consequences for people who commit crime in their stores. We're hearing more and more, especially from women in retail, that they don't feel safe turning up to do their jobs. And I don't blame them. We needed to see action a long time ago. Now that the government has promised that there'll be money, it needs to front on how they'll actually get that money out the door. Because just this weekend, I attended a protest on Queen Street with around 500 retailers from across our community. They're scared, they're anxious, they're worried for themselves and their family members because Janak Patel's death, it could have happened to any of them. And we need to keep our community members safe and give real consequences to criminals, but actually follow through on the promises that the government makes.
Your party leader, David Seymour, and yourself have been active at protests, and you've criticised, particularly David has criticised the Prime Minister for not being in Sandringham the day after the tragedy occurred. Is this a fair criticism, as Ardern has rejected that she hasn't been enough involved in the community?
Well, look, I believe the Prime Minister herself has admitted that she has not gone to visit any retailer who has been the victim of one of these serious offences before the death of Jeanette Patel. I don't think that's good enough. You know, we have people every day being robbed. We have people every month. I think there was 14 ram raids last month, and the government says this is a good thing because the number is dropping. Well, we don't believe any ram raid is good. And we don't believe any retailer or store worker who's feeling unsafe or feeling as though they could be at threat of losing their life for selling people goods in the community is acceptable. We have to do better. And I believe if the government ministers actually went and talked to people in the community, could see up front how scared and vulnerable people are feeling, and actually listen to their concerns, we would see that money getting out the door. But instead, we've had promises, we've had broken promises, and we've had money promised but not actually delivered on.
One big part of this package is the Fog Cannon subsidy scheme, which is an expansion of this investment into fog cannons. Does ACT believe this is the most effective measure to deter retail crime?
We believe that fog cannons are what the community are calling for because they need any form of defence from the lawlessness that's occurring in their shops, and I can't blame them for that. What the ACT Party would want as a deterrent for getting the crime easier in the first place is ankle bracelets on people who are repeat offenders, because we know there are people in our community constantly committing these crimes. If they do it time and time again, we should put ankle bracelets on them so the police know where they are, when they've been at the scene of the crime, and if they try and cut them off, put them into a facility, because it's not good enough that we have people who are scared to do their jobs, and we have people who are afraid that they will lose their lives for just wanting a job in our economy and being helpful to the community. We need real consequences for lawlessness, and so yes, I think fog cannons is a good start so people have an action they can take in their own stores, but we've really got to get to the heart of the issue and stop those crimes from being committed in the first place.
Just to clarify, those ankle bracelets, would you suggest that this also include children who are repeat offenders, as National has suggested?
Oh, look, the ACT Party has suggested this before the National Party. If you're young enough to do the crime, you should be young enough to face the consequences. There should be a deterrent for anybody of any age who wants to commit serious offences in our community. If you're, you know, 20 years old or 11 years old and you're going and ram raiding or you're going in and threatening shop workers with violence, you are old enough to wear an ankle bracelet.
So you would extend it to any age at all if they were a repeat offender of something like a retail crime?
Oh, look, I think if you are of the age of 11 or 12, you should definitely be old enough. If you're also able to drive a car and you're ram raiding the shop, be able to wear the ankle bracelet to prevent you from doing that. At the moment, that's not what our law allows.
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
Butico Beats with Enrique Morales and guests with support from Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow,
a live tribute to Mac Miller followed by Carlotta and Momo.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Wednesdays, one to four with Bridge. Tune in for your fair share of great open-minded tracks. A wide range of supportive and encouraging music with Bridge. Kick back and chill with the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge. Your vibes aren't ever the same.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. A group of students at the University of Auckland have launched a student-led petition in support of tertiary education unions' strike action. The petition has now garnered over 1,300 signatures. This comes as staff who are members of the union have extended a ban on entering or releasing student grades until Thursday as part of their strike action for better pay. I spoke to Izzy Renton and Maria Kopilovich from Students Supporting TEU about why they decided to launch this petition.
My name is Izzy and I am on the Masters of Conflict and Terrorism Studies. I've been studying at University of Auckland for a couple of years now. Before that I was doing a graduate diploma. And so yes, I'm a student at the University of Auckland.
I'm the same as Izzy. I'm doing a Master of Conflict and Terrorism Studies. So my name is Maria. I also did a Bachelor of Global Studies at the university. So I've been here for about 4.5 years, still going.
You've launched a student-led petition in support of tertiary education union strike action. Could both of you tell me why this is something you personally wanted to do?
The main reason is that I think, certainly for me, when I first heard about the strike action, it was probably a little bit after the fact. It was certainly after semester had ended and when we were already at a point where people had been waiting for their grades for a while. And I think what stood out to me was that obviously the staff were trying to, had gotten to a place where they felt like they needed to disrupt service and this was the way they were going to do it. And that relied upon, you know, impacting the students, relied upon the students reacting to that and putting pressure on the university. And certainly speaking to fellow students, I think when they realized why the grade strike was happening, the sort of majority of people that I spoke to were very much in support of staff. You know, lecturers contribute a lot of time to creating course materials. They devote a lot of time to student progression. They're the people that we really have the most contact with at the university. So I think on the whole, everyone I spoke to was very much in support of the action, but perhaps like hadn't realized it was happening or hadn't realized why it was impacting grades. And so it just seemed like a logical step to create a way that students could express their support for the strike action and also, you know, take part in that disruption in terms of actually putting some pressure on the university and being part of that process.
Yeah, I think that just following on from that point is that many students weren't aware and of why these grades weren't being released. And I feel like a lot of, you know, not just we're just coming from a student perspective where we could get other students who clearly support their staff and want a better quality of education in that regard. So we just decided to, you know, get the student voice involved as much as we could.
And obviously this is a nationwide effort, but what do you both think about the University of Auckland's response to this situation?
I definitely, and you know, again, obviously we're coming from this from the perspective of students. So we haven't been like, you know, we haven't been on the front line, so to speak, in terms of negotiations and everything. I think we're definitely aware of the frustration around the university's response, and that's definitely something that has contributed to us doing the petition. I think because, and again, this ties back into us giving the students an opportunity to have a voice in this, is that I think when students didn't realize what was happening, and I think, you know, often students are painted as like kind of radical, making a fuss about everything, you know, when actually I think at the beginning of the grade strike, when people didn't realize what was happening, it demonstrated actually how much students are willing to just kind of sit quietly and wait for something, you know, sit quietly and wait for their results to come out and kind of lump the implications of what will happen in that process. And I think, unfortunately, because students weren't aware of what was happening, that gave the university space to kind of speak for students. And I've obviously seen the communications from the university, which, you know, do talk about the disruption to students and do sort of implicitly, whether purposeful or not, place the blame on the staff members who are striking. And so I think what's frustrating about that is that they're placing themselves as working in the interests of the students, but actually what we hear from the students is that they do want quality education. They want their staff to be well paid. They don't want their staff to be stretched super thin so that they can't kind of respond to problems and respond to student issues and, you know, and provide them with the best quality of education. And so, again, like, this was an opportunity to say, well, actually, no, this is the student's perspective on this, and we don't agree that the problem is with the staff.
Yeah.
We believe that, you know, if negotiations have been going on for a long time, then the university has some responsibility for not having managed that better.
And a lot of the, you know, students like ourselves actually work for the university as well. You know, the tutors are very overstretched and they're overworked. And so when we have these communications from the university, sometimes it does, yeah, it doesn't necessarily align with how, you know, all the students feel. And so this really was a way to say, you know, we're actually supporting the TU because we do believe in their mission. And we want to see change for our staff, but also that's going to contribute and, like, positively impact the students themselves.
And I also think, you know, what our petition demonstrates is that the interest of the students is really in line with the interest of the staff.
Mm.
And if the university is not serving its staff members and it's not serving its students, then really who is the university serving is the big question.
One of the university's arguments for not paying some of their staff a living wage, particularly those students that are also staff, is that the living wage is calculated based on a family of four. Do you think this is sort of a justified reason to not meet this demand?
So in terms of the details of the demands and the university's responses to them, I think that's probably where our, like, knowledge isn't as well developed as, say, somebody from the TEU or somebody who's involved in the negotiations. I think the way that we're viewing it is, A, the messaging that we're getting from the university is not aligning with the experience of the staff that we have contact with every day, who all seem to be working very hard to cover the gaps that have been created during the pandemic, and also, like, you know, following the pandemic when they reduced personnel and it means that staff are spread across a lot more work than they previously had to do. And then obviously you see the figures from the 2021 annual report, which show that, you know, the university has made a surplus of $133 million. And that's based off of an enrollment of over 36,000 students, over 3,000 of which are foreigner students, which is almost back up to pre-pandemic levels. I think it's just 63 fewer than they had pre-pandemic. So although we don't know the specifics of the negotiation and the reasons that have been given, from the student perspective, there seems to be a kind of misalignment in terms of, like, obviously we understand that the university has to, be functional for, like, in the long term. But at the same time, we're witnessing that, you know, our staff are super stretched and that is affecting the quality of education. And so for us, I think it moves into this broader question about the devaluation of education and the impact that that has on us as students and also on broader society, which, you know, we're all members of. And, you know, there's a real worry that if staff at universities aren't protected, then that will impact quality of education that is delivered. And I think another really important thing to us is that, globally, universities have been shown to be, like, a really significant tool for leveling inequalities. And in New Zealand, census data shows that degree holders, they get better, they have better job security, they earn more over their working lives. And one of the things that I observe within the university is that when staff become more stretched, it becomes, like, the onus gets put upon students to compete for staff time. And as soon as students have to compete for staff time, that benefits, you know, students who have more confidence or who are more used to working in these sorts of systems. And unfortunately, those kind of qualities often align with socioeconomic inequalities. And so it means that you start to get this unintended consequence where, because staff are stretched, it begins to exacerbate those differences, because the people who are able to fight for the time and fight for the quality of education are the people who, you know,
most vulnerable.
Well, the people who aren't able to fight for that time are usually the students who are most vulnerable. And so it becomes a question of quality of education, but it also becomes a question of the role of the university as an equalizing tool in society. And, you know, what do we lose and what inequalities do we exacerbate by not protecting the university as an institution and our staff and their well-being?
That was Izzy Renton and Maria Kopilevich from Students Supporting TEU. And we'll include a link to their petition in the B-cast of this interview, which you can find on 95bfm.com after the show. And they're encouraging people to sign the petition before they send it to the University of Auckland tomorrow.
The Wire.
But there's some real fascists out here.
You're tuned into The Wire. Let us know what you think of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. Now we'll be talking about a new report from Talent Rise, a recruitment specialist that comprised the experiences of over 200 young people. The report has suggested that job search confidence is low and fears of the future relating to gaining employment is high. I spoke to Kai Arahi at Talent Rise New Zealand, Jessica Te Moanui, about the report and why young people in Aotearoa are struggling to gain meaningful employment. Here is that interview.
Some of the things that came out of the report is that we found that 69% of those rangatahi, or those young people that we spoke to, are really fearful about the availability of relevant jobs when it comes to entering the workforce and building a career. And I think, you know, that's a real worry, especially when you look at 50% of them have been looking for work for over 3 months. You know, we spoke to young people who had been looking or trying to secure a role for 12 months or more. And I think one of the other things that came out of that report, and we have known this for some time and we have been trying to talk to employers about it, that when you're advertising for an entry-level role, it really needs to be an entry-level role, because what we're finding is those entry-level roles are not actually entry-level when they're asking for 2 years' worth of relevant experience.
The young people surveyed, were these people that have tertiary qualifications and are looking to move into the workforce in the relevant area that they've studied?
Would be a mix of young people who have tertiary qualifications and then a mix of young people who don't. I mean, we interviewed one young person who said that they were a university student with no previous job experience, and that most of the jobs that they were looking at required experience in their related field, and that they'll prioritise those who match that criteria. So with no work experience for that Rise Day participant, it had been really challenging them to receive a job offer, which was just heartbreaking, being that they were a university student and were studying, you know, to be a specialist in that field.
You've reported that 56% of respondents cited that little or no work experience was holding them back from getting their first role. Could you talk a little bit about some of the barriers that might be preventing people from getting that work experience?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. So we can't kind of just put it on employers, because I've already mentioned how we know that when they're advertising for entry level, it's not just entry level. I think some of the other barriers can be when it comes to job searching, that young people, they're not really too sure how to read a job advert. And so part of our Talent Rise program, we mentor and coach our young people how to look at a job advert and what some of these things mean. Because sometimes there's some quite technical terminology in that job advert where they might have relevant experience in doing something house, which also kind of means what they're looking for, but just in a different context, if you kind of get what I mean. So I think that's one of the barriers. I think another barrier is CV, being able to put a CV and a cover letter together, being able to market your transferable skills as well as your technical skills as well. I think that's a huge barrier. And then I also think that if they were perhaps to make it to that next stage, then their confidence in interviewing without that coaching and that mentoring, they can quite struggle to sell themselves in an interview.
Should universities have more of a role in preparing their graduates, or any other tertiary qualification, should they have a role in sort of preparing their graduates for the workplace and securing their first job? And how could they maybe do this?
Absolutely. I think not just universities, I think it also falls back on any tertiary education providers, probably at college or high school level as well. I think, you know, we focus a lot on education, but then we kind of lose out a little bit on those building up those transferable soft skills, also those life skills as well. And I really think that those kind of things are really important for a young person when they're about to embark on their career journey. And I guess, you know, we're quite lucky in a sense because that's provided a space for us, for Talent Rise, to be able to do what we do, and being the not-for-profit of a global IT recruitment specialist, you know, CV and interview prep and preparing people for the workforce really is our bread and butter. It's what we do.
There are other barriers, right, to people securing employment. The cost of living is something that many students and young people are struggling with. So did you see any of these trends emerge in the respondents' answers?
We saw a little bit there because we saw that 35% were concerned about the economy and the impact that that was having on them finding work. We also, in New Zealand here, because we are working in this space, what we know is what our young people, our rangatahi, have told us is that there is a lot of pressure on them from their families, especially if they're living at home, to secure employment. And that is because the cost of living is really high. Therefore, there's a lot of pressure on our young people to contribute into the household costs. I think on the flip side of that, with the lack of housing and the housing shortage, some of the pressure that our young people are feeling at the moment is that there is a lot of uncertainty around if they're going to ever be able to buy a house, enter into that owning your own home market. And I think, you know, it's a real concern. Just with the economy, there's a lot of uncertainty around there in regards to securing a job and setting themselves up financially for their future.
What, in your opinion, could be done to ensure that young people in Aotearoa are able to secure meaningful employment?
I mean, our key whakatauki here at Talent Rise is e hara taku toa I te toa takitahi, e nari he toa takitini, which really talks about success is not that of one, but that of a collective. I really think that we should really wrap around and support our young people. You know, these are our future leaders. We should put more time and effort into empowering them to succeed, allowing them to become the future leaders of Aotearoa.
That was Kai Aorahi at Talent Rise New Zealand, Jessica Te Moana Nui, on their Fear of the Future report. We'll be right back after this short break. In the meantime, let us know what you think of our pieces today. Text in on 5395.
The countdown is on. Sharon Van Etten and her full band are playing at Auckland's magnificent Civic Theatre on Monday, December the 12th. Sharon Van Etten is one of this century's great songwriters. With a live show described as nothing short of stunning, come and witness a legend being written in real time. With support from Nadia Reid, we'll say it again, this is quite simply unmissable magic.
Wellington is sold out. Grab the last remaining Auckland tickets now from Ticketmaster.
Okay, I got up at 5 a.m. I waxed on my board. I waxed off my board, which was a mistake because then I had to wax it again. I'm ready to go surfing, bruh.
Did you watch Point Break?
Yes.
I don't know.
Come on, we do everything together. We're like Simon and Garfunkel. We're Hall and Oates, bruh. We're like the sexy twins from Bros. Let me come surfing with you.
Oh, damn. Actually, look at that. Solid zero on the west coast. Surf's off, Soz.
Come on!
The 95BFM Surf Report. All the surf, all the time. Weekdays on Breakfast and Drive. Thanks to Pro Gear Photographic.
It's music.
95. Dans une pièce vite remplie d'agate, je m'allonge sur le tapis.
Keep some tricks up your sleeve.
I need you, I wanna tell you, I need you.
Yes. Keep some glitters on the sheet, on the sheet.
95 BFM, the original originator.
95 should have been the single.
Wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute.
We're an underground radio station here.
BFM.
Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
Trees, mountains, a curious kittadoo.
It's time for the Green Desk with Francis on 95BFM.
The Waitemata Harbour is an intertidal ecosystem inhabited by clams, cockles, crabs, algae and microscopic worms. In a recent University of Auckland study on the effects of microplastics in the Waitemata Harbour, PhD candidate Sam Laidwig found that plastic pollution is fundamentally altering the natural cycles of life in the harbour's waters. The investigation found that microplastic pollution is altering the flow of oxygen through the systems, and the long-term effects of this are currently unknown. This week on the Green Desk, I spoke to Laidwig about the study and the harms of plastic pollution on New Zealand's oceans. Can you tell our listeners a little about the study and why you wanted to investigate the effects of microplastics in the Waitemata Harbour?
Absolutely. So this study was a survey of the Waitemata Harbour to get an understanding of how microplastic pollution is affecting the harbour and the ecosystem that lives there and potentially affecting us humans. And this type of study has not been done before, so we really have, up until this point, had no understanding of the real-world effects of microplastics. And our knowledge was based on laboratory studies that showed us possibly what could be happening, but this one confirmed that there is a real-world effect of microplastics at the ecosystem level, which is quite concerning, but now we know.
That's really interesting. So how long did the study take?
Between 2.5 to 3 years, and it doesn't normally take that long, but because of COVID being about and lockdowns and that, we kind of had some brief pauses, I guess.
And what do the findings of your investigation mean for New Zealand waters?
It means that we really should be taking some action on plastic pollution, politically speaking, but also in industry and thinking about how we're using plastics, and then also just as a people when we go about our daily lives, you know, if we're purchasing plastic products from the grocery stores or things like this, just to be mindful of how much plastic we're consuming, because it really is affecting our ecosystem, which does tie back to us and our life and our resources, our water and our food quality. It all ties in to the study's findings.
So what urgent measures would you call on Aotearoa to introduce based on the findings you made of plastic pollution in the harbour?
That's a really good question. I'm sorry, I don't actually have an answer.
No, that's okay.
prepared for that one.
That's okay. Do you have any things that you do in your everyday life to do with minimizing plastic that you could probably suggest to some of our listeners to do themselves?
Definitely. So finding ways that I can avoid purchasing plastic has really helped, I think, and I've seen a dramatic decrease in the amount of plastic that I use just from not buying plastic water bottles, but having some sort of filtered water system either at the house or in the refrigerator or something like this. And staying away from packaging, that's a big one. I think a lot of our products that we purchase online, that's mostly wrapped in plastic, and there are businesses out there today that are making an effort to wrap it in some other sort of material that does pretty good too.
That was University of Auckland PhD candidate Sam Laidwig on her research of microplastic pollution in the Waitemata Harbour.
You've been listening to The Green Desk with Francis on 95BFM. That was The Wire.
Ko iriti hotaka katoa, mō tēne wiki, nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki o mō, tēne rā. That is a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Ex-Brooke Van Velden, Izzy Renton and Maria Kopilevich from Student Supporting TEU, Kaya Rahi at Talent Rise New Zealand, Jessica Te Moana Nui, and University of Auckland PhD candidate Sam Laidwig. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.